You're listening to the British Baseball Podcast. Find out where they are.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
There's all sorts of like gold, and this is one of the things that I was excited to do on the podcast, is to try and share this information that's popping up, because there's so much passion and love gone into Project Cobb document.
But it's things like BritBall, where they got their information from, and the people that did that, and the Baseball Mercury that Will Morgan did.
Yeah.
That would be the late 60s and 70s.
Yeah, Baseball Courier goes back to the 60s.
Baseball Courier as well, yeah. And I did, when I was president the first time, I did a bulletin type thing that I sent to all teams, and I can't remember what I called that. Remember it, because it was on yellow paper. Why it was on yellow paper, I don't know. I probably got that three in the office.
Was it line drive? It's line drive, nope. Knuckleball.
Nope.
Baseball Courier, Baseball Mercury.
Nope. It wasn't. Well, there may not be any copies anywhere.
That'd be a shame.
Yeah.
One of the segments I do in the show is about baseball history in Britain. So okay. I look through all these old fanzines and magazines and publications to get all the... I've got Harvey Socker's book and Josh Chetwynd's Baseball in Europe, just to cross-reference and fact-check things, and just like a 20-minute, half-an-hour video of what happened within like September in British baseball history, and just go through some like the higher points and lower points. And there's loads. I love that's what I've tried to do with that show, is make it like an audio fanzine. And try and replicate the style, because there's a real like loving charm about those issues and magazines that I think you don't get anymore with any sort of media.
That's a great video that Josh put up on Facebook. Was it Facebook this week?
Yeah.
1911.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
incredible. I was at a meeting some years ago, 20 years ago. What is it? 2020, probably 30 years ago, at the Queen's Club, the tennis Queen's Club at Queen's. And there's a big plaque on the wall about a baseball game.
Yeah.
With a copy of the program, I think it was.
Oh wow!
I can't remember now which game it was or any details about it, but
there's a blue plaque moment. From September, there was a game, I think it might have been from 1745, and one of the cricket clubs.
Really?
Yeah, and they had a game with, I think it was from the GB national team, and like a bit of an all-star thing.
When was that?
This is going back a couple of years now, but the original game was played on the ground that got the blue plaque was from 1745.
1745?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that'll be, is that what they term the little pocketbook?
I think so. The German
I can't remember the publication. It was a lady that wrote something, wasn't it, called the little pocketbook?
Yes, there was.
I can't remember that much about it, but
and this is what I'm finding out. The more that I dig and the more that I find, it's just been brilliant, and it's one of the things that's kept me going. Right, so the thing is getting to, because for me, that there's a lot of literature that's about from like 1930s with the original pro leagues and stuff, but there's a massive gap between then and like the start of like the 80s and the 90s,
really
stuff. It's sort of there's more information coming through with the with like some of the finals and the programs that they had and the information is there, but all the like the juicy stuff seems around about the 1890s when it first started and the 1930s league.
That's a shame, because there was a lot going on in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The 50s was mainly because the American Air Force bases were still dotted around the country.
Yeah.
So they played, and a few Brits played as well. but even round here, there were three American Air Force bases around Nottingham area.
Yeah.
Newton, RAF Newton. There was somewhere right near Ratcliffe-on-Trent and a lot of people that I started to play with in the 60s were people that were playing with the Americans in the 50s.
Wow.
So, you know, I heard a lot of stories, which I can't remember much of it now, but a lot of stories. But yeah, there's probably nothing, not a great deal put on paper.
Yeah, what a shame.
Which is a shame. Yeah. But I mean, somewhere I've got a plaque that was given to us from the IBA, International Baseball Association, to celebrate the 100th anniversary. So when I go onto the BBF website, and the first thing it says on its first page is that the BBF was formed in 1987, does it say?
Something like that. Yeah.
87 or 88, something like that. It just makes my blood boil. Because the history goes back, the governing body for baseball in this country goes back to 1892 or whatever it was.
Yes.
that's on this plaque.
Yeah,
and the fact it changed its name is irrelevant.
Yeah,
the Football Association changed its name several times. The Football League changed its name. Governing bodies changed their name. The reason we changed our name to the BBF is it was called the British Amateur Baseball Federation.
Yeah.
And we thought it was not a real brilliant idea to have the word amateur in it because it pulled up some connotations.
Okay.
So we dropped the amateur. But prior to that, it was BASF, British American Baseball and Softball Federation. BABSF. And it was that from... Well, in actual fact, when I first joined the Federation on its National Council, whatever it was called, it was called the National Baseball League. Then it became the BABSF. Then softball decided, there was only about three teams in softball at that time. They decided they want to, I don't know whether it was, I was going to, no, I'm going to say a name called Frome. No, it wasn't Fromer, but I thought it was Frome. Or something like that, phoned me at home in the whenever, the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, and said that softball wanted to do their own thing. And we said, yeah, if that's what you want, that's fine. And then we became the British Amateur Baseball Federation. Then we became British Baseball Federation. Huh? So just the fact that we changed our name doesn't mean we were formed in 1987 or whatever the thing is. So it just makes, anyway.
That's really interesting. That is really interesting. It's some great insight there. But what I'd be interested as well is like how did you actually start off in baseball? Because you come before you started playing baseball. A lot of people I've spoken to, their interest in baseball is either through John and Josh's show on Channel 5 with the MLB, or they find out about the internet and without this sounding incorrect, but like you would have started playing well before internet was about and before Channel 5. So how did you find out about baseball and what was it that attracted you to it?
I started playing before there was calculators. and that's true, that is. I started playing, the story was, I worked for a company in Nottingham, and on the 6th of June 1966, 6666, which is a date that I can easily remember.
Yeah.
Somebody joined the firm, came into our office, and his name was Alec Williams, and he turned around to me towards the end of the summer and said, are you not playing sports in the summer? So I said, no, I play football in the winter, but I don't play cricket anymore. And he said, well, why don't you come and try baseball? So he took me down to one of the Nottingham Lions practice sessions on I don't know if it was a Tuesday or a Wednesday night. And basically, I got hooked ever since from that very day. So it'd be probably around about August 1966. It was a long time ago.
And what are your earliest memories of playing baseball around that time?
Having to walk about 8 miles for indoor practice in the January and February of 1967. But first memories of playing the game. I spent probably first season, 67, on the bench. And I remember going to Hull Royals, funnily enough, to their ground up in Hull. There was about 12 of us in the squad, and I was the only one that didn't get one inning of games. And I was so angry and so annoyed that I wrote benchman across my glove, across the thumb part of my glove, and slung it on the coach to go home. And a good friend of mine said, "Mike, don't get mad at it. Do better at it." And his name was Norman Wells. No, it wasn't. I mentioned the name Norman Wells once before today. It was Norman Smith. And he took me into outfield practice and he hit me dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and maybe hundreds of fly balls.
Yeah.
And he said, "The only way to get a game, Mike, is to get better. So make yourself indispensable in the outfield." And that was my first memory of him hitting me hundreds and hundreds of fly balls. And I got in the outfield, played in the outfield for a couple of years from memory, and then started catching, went to play catcher in the late 60s, 69, 70. I've always been involved in sports, I've always played sports, and I've got a thing that if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do all of it. I'm all in. I'm not half in, half out. I put everything into it. I put my heart and my soul into it.
Yeah.
And I could see that the catcher did an awful lot of the work. So I wanted to be a catcher. I wanted to be the main man, apart from the pitcher. That came later. But I wanted to be the catcher because he was in the game all the time.
Yeah.
And did that for a couple of years.
That's really cool.
I got cleaned out one game and I realised how dangerous it was.
I've seen some collisions, and I used the excuse of having really old knees as a not to give it a go. I mean, a couple of years ago, I think I would have loved to have give it a try, but I think now that my time's passed, there's Springer chickens that are a lot more eager and keener than I to try out that position. So I'll let them.
We were in dire need of needing a pitcher, so I went onto the mound instead.
Yeah. Was that out of your own choice, or were you sort of...
No, it was out of necessity because there was nobody else. We had a pitcher called Dennis Smith, who was Norman's brother, and he's, for some reason, he just stopped turning up. So we needed a pitcher. And Alec Williams, again, he took me on the field and taught me how to pitch, or taught me the mechanics of pitching. So I became a pitcher. And pitch for, till virtually the end of my career in 84.
What's some of the best pitching advice that you got given?
There was a fellow playing for the old Nottingham Lions when I first started. His name was Johnny Shutt. And he was a beanpole. He was about 6'4" and a beanpole. And he could throw a hard ball. He threw a very hard ball. And his advice to me was, if you ever start to pitch, just decide what you want to do and do that. If they keep hitting you, keep doing it, because they won't hit you every time. If you've got a curveball that's not working, don't stop using it, because it will get them eventually. And I used that right through my pitching career. I didn't have much speed, so I had to use a bit of craft. I had what I call, I didn't call it anything. It was a knuckle swerve ball. It was a weird old thing, but I would get batters on the floor and the ball would go in the strike zone. I'd get it to drop and curve and do all sorts of things I did. And that was very successful for probably about 4 or 5 years before people cottoned onto it. And in actual fact, somebody telegraphed today about a four or five page piece on us in their Sunday supplement. And they called it the famous Mike Harold curveball.
Nice.
Or the infamous, I beg your pardon, the infamous Mike Harold curveball.
One for the scrapbook.
Yeah, I've still got a copy.
Cool. What was the baseball landscape like in the 60s? Like there's a lot of information that's out there about certain periods of time within British baseball history, but it doesn't seem to be much around about the 50s and 60s. But with you starting off in the 60s, is there much that you can tell us about that time period?
There wasn't an awful lot around. We were based in Nottingham. We were the only team around Nottingham. We had to travel to Hull for our nearest away game. In fact, we travelled to Hull. We played Hull Royals, Hull Aces, and then Hull Mustangs, I think, or something like that. And a couple of games in Birmingham was the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
There was a lot more teams down in London. The Manchester Stretford Saints started up in the early 70s. That then became another local away game. But there was probably only about 30, 35 teams in the country, because by this time the Americans had left. The bases had closed and the Americans left. So we were kind of left on our own and managed until about, I would say, the mid-70s, it started to get a bit more popular. It did. And by the time I was president in 92, I think we'd got 130 teams, 130, 100. Just over 100 senior teams and about 110 maybe junior teams.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. What do you think caused that boom then after the forces left?
A lot of work. A lot of hard work. An awful lot of hard work by a lot of people. We got a bit of sponsorship in the late 80s from Scottish Amicable, which helped publicise the game quite a bit. It got on radio quite a bit because of that. We started playing internationally again. We went to Italy in 71. We played in 73, 75. Then it went quiet until 84, and we had the European B Group Championships in Hull in 1984, which drew a lot of publicity, so pulled in a lot of players, and it just grew. I don't take an awful lot of the credit, but I put in place when I was president. At the same time, I put in place a team of people that were hardworking, wanted to be involved, and knew how to be involved, if that makes sense. I had somebody that knew about publicity to do publicity, some that knew about youth to do the youth program. I had an umpire in charge of umpires and so on. And I had a coach doing the coaching clinics, and they did a terrific job, and reached out to a lot of people. And when I became team manager, one of the first things I did was I insist all the members of the GB team coached a team locally. And if they hadn't got a team locally, they formed a team locally. I couldn't insist on it, but I highly recommended it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a condition of being a part of the squad, but it didn't go down well if they didn't do it. And that a lot of junior teams were formed from that, by players going out there and doing some coaching and becoming role models. I mean, I heard your interview with Alex Malahoudis, and he talked about him having Alan Bloomfield as a role model. And I always felt that the GB players should become role models, because then the young players would have something to emulate, somebody to idolize and somebody to copy. We might talk about, we might talk later about why, about the current GB system, but maybe or maybe not.
Okay. What sorts of things have you had to overcome to play baseball? Anything that have been challenging or any difficulties?
The only two things that really come to mind from a personal point of view is one, I'm an extremely shy person. A lot of people that hear this might actually say, it must be joking, but what I do in baseball is not an act, but it's a performance. And work was a performance. Away at home, or out of the limelight, never in the limelight. I'm a very shy person. I know some people think I've been quite ignorant, but I'm not ignorant. I'm just shy, and I always have been. I had a bit of a problem when I was 7. Put my head through a plate glass window and lost most of my face, most of my nose, most of my lips. Had a lot of scarring and took a lot of, as you do as kids. Yeah, took a lot of ribbing as a kid, and that put me in the corner. So if I go, even now, if I go to a function, you'll see me sitting in the corner. Doesn't mean I don't want to mix. It means I'm fine if somebody comes up and starts talking to me, but I'm not good at initiating conversation. I'm not. So I had to overcome that shyness, and it taught me, baseball taught me to put on the performance, to be a performer. And what was the other thing? It's gone now. The other thing that happened to me in my young life is I got measles and I lost the sight in my right eye. So I had to cope with sight in one eye, which doesn't sound too difficult to overcome until you're playing sport. The ball is coming at you at 150 miles an hour and you only got sight in one eye. I've got no vision in this right side at all. So I had to adapt quite a bit to overcome that.
How hard is it then playing baseball with sort of the depth perception issues that you would have struggled with?
Bear in mind, I don't have anything to compare it to.
That's a good point.
So it's I've only ever had from the age of 7. Actually, in fact, I was 5 when I got measles. From the age of 5, I've only ever had one eye. I remember an optician telling me when I was about 11 that my left eye was better than 20/20. I got perfect vision in it, but I'll never be able to see out the right eye. So I've no idea what depth perception is, because I can only see what I can see out of the one eye.
That's amazing. Wow, brilliant. That's quite motivating and inspirational. But who are some of them like more motivating and which players or managers or people had the most impact on you then as a young athlete or throughout your career, I suppose?
I guess Alec Williams was a big influence in me. He introduced me to the game. He helped me in the game. We formed a Nottingham Baseball Association. We had at one time, I think it was either 5 senior teams and 4 junior teams in Nottingham. And we did a lot of work together. We had a coaching scheme. We had an umpire scheme that we ran. And we tried to develop the game locally, we formed, I think it was 4 teams in Nottingham, Newark, Leicester. We helped form. We advertised in the local paper for ex-players from the 50s and 60s to take on new teams. And we got 4 people who used to play, some I used to play with in the 60s, and they took on new teams. And yeah, he was a big influence. We kind of went our separate ways in the, I guess, the early 80s. So he was a big influence on me. The chap I've already mentioned, Johnny Shutt, he was a big influence on me. And the fella that hit me hundreds of baseballs, Norman, he was a good friend and gave me a lot of help.
That's brilliant. Were there any sort of sliding doors moments then? Like, was it a point when Norman was trying to get you to play baseball, did you ever think, now I'll give this one a miss? Or no, were you always going to go for it?
No. From that first training or practice, I hate calling it training because athletes train, baseball players practice. We practice plays. We don't train. From that very first practice session, I just fell in love with the game. I just was hooked, line and sinker. And 55 years later, I still have the same feeling and the same butterflies when I go to a game.
Excellent. At what point in your career did you go into management, especially with the national team? How did that all come about?
Well, I had a lot of problems with my shoulder, with pitching, and I just got to the point in 84 that the GB European B Group Championships in Hull, they was going to be my last tournament. So retired from playing at that point, although I did have to pitch occasionally after that, but basically retired and took over management of the Nottingham Hornets, or Southglade Hornets they were called then, of the Nottingham Hornets. And because there was nobody else to do it, and I thought I had a bit of an intelligence about baseball intelligence about me, and I thought I'd learnt a lot about the game. So I took them on, and in 1988, in the spring of 1988, the B group was going to be played in Birmingham, and I was asked to be one of the coaches that went around the country doing tryouts for the GB team. And we did four tryouts, and at the end of the fourth tryout, which was in Burtonwood, I think it was, up in Lancashire, yeah. The BBF board asked me if I would be interested in managing the team. So, yeah, please. How much better can it get? Probably only playing, but managing is the next best thing to playing. And I said, yes, please. Yeah, I'll have a go at that. Yeah, very proud. Very proud. Every time I pulled on a GB uniform, put a GB cap on my head, very, 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 very proud. Every time. And still am when I see people with GB on their uniform.
Yeah, I just saw a photo of Drew Spencer getting on a plane going to Italy, where clad in all his GB attire. And I was just like, I'd love to have one of those hoodies. Yeah. But it's one of those things I know I'll never get, because I think it's something you got to earn, rather than just sort of buy it. And it's just like, anyone that I see wearing one, I'd be like, I'd buy you a beer.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say, I remember having this conversation with the then president in about 1993 or four or somewhere around there. He wanted to do merchandise, GB merchandise. And I said, well, I don't think it's right that people wear a GB cap unless they've earned it. And I don't think they should wear a GB jersey or something with Great Britain baseball on it until they've earned it. But times have changed.
Does doing 100 episodes of a podcast about British baseball qualify me for a hoodie?
Yes, it does. Well, I think it should. I think it should. In fact, I meant to re-congratulate you on that 100, because that's tremendous achievement.
Thank you.
And good luck to the next 100.
Yeah, I will keep saying that. And every time I do it, I feel myself suddenly like, oh my word. It's like one of the most stressful things in the world, this. But speaking of amazing achievements, I've just pulled up your Hall of Fame entry. I don't know if you've seen this, but there's some great stuff in here that we can talk about. Michael Harold was a Great Britain national team's longest tenured manager, leading the squad to a European title in 1988 and the juniors to a championship in 1993. His exceptional career also included stints as a distinguished player at both the national and domestic levels, as well as success as a manager in domestic league play. A talented catcher, pitcher, Harold was named to GB squads for the 1971 and 1984 European Championships, as well as European qualifying games in 74 and 75. As a member of the national Nottingham Lions from 1970 to 76, he led his club to two league championships, two league cups, and a national knockout cup title. During that stretch, he was named the club's MVP, most valuable batter twice and most valuable player once. With success, more success followed with the Southglade Hornets from 79 to 92.
Yeah.
The dominant Midlands club, which he pitched for and then began to manage in 85, capturing 9 league titles and 8 cup trophies, and with a number of other pieces of hardware, most notably a national knockout cup trophy in 86 during his tenure.
Yeah.
And that's only half of it. There's a lot more. Like, I skipped the GB national team. Like I said before, there's area with non-domestic players. We're not representing large contingents of the national team. There was a squad made up of primarily born and bred British players. And that title in 88 in European Championships B pool. What do you remember about those European Championships?
Quite a bit, obviously. Quite a bit. Well, quite a bit, but then not as much as I should. A long time, whatever it is. I can't do the maths like that. Anyway, it's like 40 years ago, is it? 43 years ago, is it? Or 33 years ago?
Yeah,
33 years ago. What was interesting was after that last tryout that we had, when they asked me to be the manager, and I said, yeah, I'd be delighted. They said, okay, we have to go in a meeting now and pick the squad. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, that's fine. And there was a committee of, I guess, probably 4 or 5 people. And they chose the squad. I had very little say in it at all. Although, on reflection, I'd have probably picked 99% the same players. But I was kind of stuck with their squad. We didn't have a great deal of build-up at all. We didn't. The games were played in Birmingham, and we stayed at the Aston, I think it was the Aston University campus, and we had a couple of training sessions on one of their fields. And I remember, in actual fact, before our first game, my wife had a pretty bad car accident, so... the very early morning, or was it the day before, the night before, I had to fly back at Old Fly. I had to drive back into Nottingham and see if she was all right, see if the family was all right, sort her car out, and then get back again for the first game. But I remember watching the Czech team warming up or doing a practice session, whatever it was. And I was frightened. I was frightened because they were so slick. They were absolutely perfect. I was worried. I was. But we played, did we play Switzerland first? Or did we play Finland first? I think we played Switzerland first. And I was extremely lucky because for the vast majority of the time I was manager, I had a young man called Brian Thurston pitching for me. And Brian was a left-hander who could control where he wanted to put the ball. He had a fair bit of speed. In fact, when I went into Europe for meetings or whatever I went into Europe, opposition manager would still ask me, is Brian still playing? Brian's still playing. This is, remember the Italian manager asking me, I remember the French people asking me, is Brian still playing? Is Brian still in your squad? He was a very good pitcher. And he won that first game on his own. I can't remember the score. I think that was the score where we still, I think that's Great Britain's biggest win, I think. I think it's still in the record books as the Britain's biggest win. And then we played Finland and we beat them quite easily. Brian didn't pitch that one. I cannot honestly remember who pitched that one. And then we had to play the Czech team. And this was, well, it was either first place or second place if we when we played the Czechs. And Brian was back on the mound, and I think we won 7-0. And he just blew them away again. He did. So I was very lucky to have Brian on the mound. I was. And yeah, it was good. And the BBF did a great job in staging the games. They did. We had a lot of people come to see it. And we were had a lot of publicity on the radios and what have you, local radios. And yeah, it kind of went very quickly. So yeah, I remember a lot about it, but I don't remember a lot of detail about it.
Do you want to know a spooky coincidence?
Go on then.
I've just used the magic power of the internet on my phone.
Yeah.
Well, we're just talking about this. The European Championship skiing's beach pool in Great Britain was on the 20th of August, 1988.
No
way.
And
we're recording this now today on the 20th of August, 2021.
Oh, wow.
GB versus the Czech Republic. You won that 11-3.
11-3, was it?
Yeah. Against Finland, that was 11-0.
11-0.
And against Switzerland was 27-4.
That's the one. That's still Britain's biggest win at international baseball, I think.
Crikey.
Yeah.
What a shame I can't get a bit more information on that. I'd love to do a bit more on that one.
But I, as a manager, I didn't have to do an awful lot apart from... I mean, what I think is interesting is from that game, I had Oscar Marcelino.
Yeah.
I had Alan Bloomfield. I had Brian Thurston. And they're all in the Hall of Fame now.
Yeah.
All three of them. They are. So I had some good players. I was lucky to have some very good players.
Yeah, it sounds like you've had an absolute squad. Who have been some of the standout players then from the national team that you had the pleasure of working with?
Well, apart from Brian Thurston was an absolute gem to play. He was a typical left-hander, which I won't use on air about left-handers, but those that know the game quite well know what left-handed pitchers are like. There's not a lot up top, but there's an awful lot in their shoulder. So Brian's, yeah, I was so lucky to have him. So what was the question, Matt, again?
It's just about some of your favourite and standout players.
Standout players. From that tournament,
yeah,
Brian stood out. There was a very good first baseman we found as well called Dan Godfrey. He didn't last very long, but he was an absolutely outstanding first baseman. I've never seen anybody stretch like him either before or since. And yeah, it was Brian's pitching. Brian's pitching was everything. It was.
That's really cool. You've also done some work with the Olympic Committee.
I did, yeah.
How did you get involved with that project?
When baseball got into the Olympics for 1992 in Barcelona.
Yeah.
And it was decided that baseball would be an Olympic sport. I think they did it 6 years before, 4 to 6 years before. I can't really remember. But it was about the time that I was asked to take over as president of the Federation because of certain problems that were about at the time. And being an Olympic sport gets you a seat on the National Olympic Committee. So I appointed myself as the representative of baseball on the National Olympic Committee, which was, I find it difficult to talk about because I still think it's a bit of a dream. I mean, I sat at the, they went around the table in alphabetical order. So we were baseball. So I sat next to badminton. Now, the representative of badminton was a chap called Craig Reedy. Craig Reedy now is a double knight. He's got a knighthood and a KCMG. He's on the IOC. He's an IOC vice president. He was chairman of the BOA, and he is the lead of the International Olympic Committee's drug agency. So that was very interesting. I used to get the the underground with Steve Cram. There were people sitting around that table that were my sporting idols, and it was just unbelievable to sit around the table with them. We had a different role, I think, then to what they've got now, although I'm not totally au fait with what happens now, because I think it's far more professional now than it was then.
Yeah.
I think it was very professional then, but what I mean is they pay people big bucks these days.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
The British Olympic Association. We kind of set the parameters of the BOA, and the staff implemented what we said, basically. It was interesting. It was also about the time when Manchester wanted the Olympics for, I think they wanted it for 92 and then wanted it again for 96. And I was an ambassador for them, for their Olympic bid, which unfortunately they failed with both times. And I was still on the National Olympic Committee when London bid for the 2012 Games, because they had put their bid in around about 2002, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And the decision was made in 2007, I think the decision was made. I think it was made, the decision was announced just after the 7/7 bombings, I think, if my memory's right. Mm. That was interesting. It was.
Back into the playing days, you said that you played well into your 60s. You were part of the old timers baseball club.
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about the old timers team.
Well, I left the GB job in 95, and I managed the Birmingham Bandits for a few years, and then did some coaching for the Northern Knights. The Northern Knights were like a touring team.
Yep.
Where you kind of went and played in tournaments in Europe. I missed playing a little bit. So I heard about the old timers and I went down to London, and which will probably be about 94, just before I finished with GB. It was good to see some old players. I didn't know many of them because it was based in London. They were nearly all London players. I'd played with a few of them in the GB teams, various GB teams, but that was great. And for some reason, they put me at shortstop. I'd never been an infielder in my life, but they put me at shortstop. I'd still got a decent arm from shortstop. And I loved it. It was great. Pull a uniform on. The only problem was, when did I finish from that? When I was 60, so that would be 98. Would it? No, 2008. So for whatever it was, 14 years, every single Sunday, I would travel all the way down to London, and on a Sunday, and come all the way back. It was heavy going.
Yeah.
It was. And I was picking up, because I was getting older, I was picking up quite a few injuries, feet, legs, knees, arms, everything hurt.
Sounds like my Sunday at the moment.
Yeah, well, it was the same when I played. It was the same when I played regularly. I would have a hot bath, as hot as the water, as hot as I could possibly stand it on a Sunday night, get in it, massage the shoulder while it was underwater, try and ease the aches and pains and the bones. And I started doing that when I played for the old timers. I'd get back, I'd get in the bath. But then my wife decided that she would become my chauffeur. So it was a lot easier when she was doing the driving, because I could just sit in the passenger seat of the car after a game and go, holy shit, I'm knackered. and it was great. But well, 2008, it became too much for her to do all that driving. So so we decided to knock that on the head. But yes, it was an Italian touring team was my last game. They were away, so they battered first. I think it was the second or third batter hit a very short one to me at shortstop. Pye went down to pick it up. It took a nasty hop off the thingy and it broke the end of my finger as I was going to collect the ball, and split it right across the whole nail. So you then think, so that was the end of that game for me. So I only played two batters. And I decided, that'll do. That's another injury to overcome. So that's when I stopped playing for them. But it was good, because we would play a lot of junior teams, a lot of minor teams, and we would do probably more coaching than playing. We would teach the kids how to play and where not to play and where to play and how to hit properly and how to throw properly. And we would try and teach the game to them.
Yeah. Are you still involved with baseball now?
Yeah, I'm still coaching the Long Eaton Storm. Yeah, they phoned me in around about 2000. I thought it was 2014, but it may be 2015, thinking about it. And say that they were starting a team up, would I go and help them? So I went down there and helped them. And in fact, you can't see it, but I'm looking at a photograph of, it doesn't have the year on, but I think it was either the 2015 or 2016 team. And we went 23-0.
Wow.
And that was either their first or their second season, probably their second season. So that was a bit of a thrill. Probably more than half the team had never played before. So that was pretty good. And we've won two national single A titles in the last 4 years. So still doing a bit. But I'll tell you something about that when we finish.
Okay. If you were told tomorrow that you were not allowed to be involved with baseball again.
All right.
What would your favourite memory be
that
would make you grateful for the game?
Grateful for the game. Oh no, it's too much. There's too much. I've coached in America. I've coached in teams. I've coached the GB team in America. GB teams in Europe. There's not many countries in Europe I've not been to, either played in or coached in. There is just far too much. But what gives me a kick now is I've not been to the Storms for about 3 weeks because I'm having awful problems with my hip.
Okay.
So I've not been able to stand for longer than 15 or 20 minutes. But the last game I went to about 4 weeks ago, we've been developing a shortstop this season, and he turned the most beautiful double play, absolutely superb. That gives me a kick every time when you work on kids or work on people and they pull off plays to perfection. That's the biggest thrill you get as a coach.
Do they all know that you're a Hall of Famer and the legend that you are within the game?
Not particularly. It's not something I've never sought. I mean, why I'm doing this, I've no idea. Because I've never sought publicity. I've never sought, a great deal of fame, if you want to call it that, or infamy. But one or two of them do, because during the off-season, we had a quiz, a Zoom team quiz.
Yeah, yeah.
And the questions, I didn't set the questions. In actual fact, I got a question wrong, which I'll tell you which it was in a minute. But they set the question, that somebody set the questions, and quite a few of them didn't know I was in the Hall of Fame until the question was asked, which of the Long Eaton Storm coaches is in the Hall of Fame? And I got that one right. What I got wrong was that the question was asked, what year did I win a junior European championship?
1993.
And I got that wrong. After I said 92. I know why I said 92, but hey, yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you came on. I'm pretty sure listeners will be glad that you came on too. I just thought you had a fascinating history within the sport, and I'm so glad that you decided to come on and share some of your stories and your adventures with me and the rest of the listeners too. I've just got a couple more questions before we get on the head. What would be your one wish for British baseball if you could have one?
You know what I really wish? I wish the BBF would forget about this world ranking thing, because it really is meaningless, and that they would tell the European Federation to relegate us to the B group and then just use British-based players. I've already explained to you, it worked for us previously. We improved the numbers and the quality of baseball in this country by having British-based players in the GB squad. Alex Malahoudis said he revered Alan Bloomfield. I revered British players, and the kids have got nothing to look up to now in the GB squad. I know there's a few, but when you're getting whatever it is, 15, 18 players from overseas playing in the GB squad, I don't think it does baseball in this country any good whatsoever. I don't, and it just denies 15, 18 players that are playing in this country the chance to play for their country. So I would wish that the BBF would use the GB team to progress British players and not some sort of world standing.
Okay, thank you, man.
Sorry, that's probably a bit controversial, but
it's your view, and that's if that's what your heart desires, it's what your heart desires.
Absolutely.
So we're down now to the last three questions, or what I like to call the bottom of the seventh. Okay. So your answers will mean that you're going to get either three strikes, or you're going to be out, or you're going to get three hits and get those bases loaded, and then we'll try and walk them off. So first question is, do you have any hidden talents?
Hidden talents?
Yeah.
For what? What, in baseball? Or any hidden talent?
Yeah.
Any hidden talents? Well, it's probably not a talent now, it's too late, but in the late 70s, 78, 79, I was asked to go for a trial to become a professional footballer with Notts County.
Oh, wow.
But I refused to do it because it would mean I couldn't play baseball on a Sunday.
Wow. Now there's a sacrifice.
So I turned it down, I did, and concentrated on my baseball. Yeah.
Looking back at how you can see, I was just going to ask you if there's any regrets, because you can see how professional football has developed compared. But I think your baseball career is not one to be regretted.
No, I don't regret it. It at all. Yeah. I wonder at times what it would have been like, but it's only a wonder. Soon passes.
Good. What are you most afraid of?
Afraid of? Striking out. I'm not afraid of anything. You know, when you get to my time of life, there's nothing to be afraid of. I've had a heart attack. I've had a couple of bouts of pneumonia. There's nothing to be afraid of. There isn't. You have to live life by the day and look forward, never look back.
Nice words. Do you have any guilty pleasures?
I don't know what that question means.
Are you a closet Taylor Swift fan, or do you have anything that you sort of like?
No,
No. Someone goes out, do you like to iron in your underpants? Or
No
guilty pleasures?
No guilty pleasures. None at all.
I have it as a question, but I don't think if you like something, you like something.
That's probably the one pleasure. Question that I will sit and ponder about for the rest of the evening.
don't burn too many of them. I'll let you have that. Bases are loaded. Time to walk them off. So, Michael, thank you again for being such a great guest. Do you have any final words or any parting advice? Any shout outs you'd like to give?
I just want to announce. I'll give you an exclusive that I've decided that I'm going to retire from participation in baseball at the end of this season. I think the body is saying you've had enough. We've got a great bunch of coaches at Storm, and it's time to pass the baton on to the younger guys, although they're in the 50s. But it's time to step aside and let and spend some time with the family, because I missed a lot of family holidays because of baseball. I want to see more of the grandchildren now. So whatever it was, 2021 will be my last season.
Was that an easy decision to make?
No, God, no. No, heartbreaking. Heartbreaking decision. I just love the game so much. I'm not going to retire from watching baseball, although I'm not a good spectator. in fact, I've been renowned as a very poor spectator. I am, because I cannot not get involved. I have plans, whether it comes to fruition, I have plans to go to grounds that I once played at, see people that probably I used to play with. I'd love to go up and see Martin Garsell up at Liverpool.
Yeah.
And see if he's still coming home from his night out in La Rochelle by curfew time, or whether I've got to wait until 1 o'clock in the morning for him to come through the hotel front door. I'd love to go and see him. It's a lot of people I'd love to go and have a chew the fat over and talk about old times.
There you go. Start your own podcast and YouTube channel about it. I tune in. Go on journey, see lots of people that you used to.
Yep.
Listen, chew the fat with and have some good stories. Write a book.
Yeah. Well, I'm writing my, not memoirs, because it's not memoirs, I'm writing my memories. Somebody once said to me, do your grandchildren know what you did in baseball? And I said, no, not really. So he said, have you got lots of trophies? I've got absolute boxes full of trophies in the lot. He said, why don't you get your grandchildren to empty the trophies for you and then talk to them about your experiences? And I thought, yeah, maybe one day. So I thought, but I better start writing down what I'm likely to forget. And a lot I have forgot. But so I've started to write down 55 years in the game, what I can still remember of what I did.
Amazing.
So that'll be interesting. And I've promised to send you a copy.
Oh, yes, please.
When it's done, as long as you don't critique it, because I'm not an author. I'm not a writer, but it might be interesting. There's a lot of things in it that you haven't covered. An awful lot that you haven't covered today.
Well, that is where we'll have part two of our conversation.
All right.
Because unfortunately, okay.
I'd love to.
To my bedtime, and I'll get in trouble with the wife.
All right.
Yeah, definitely. We'll book them for a second part. Michael, again, thank you for being such a great guest.
Thank you, man.
And I'll chat to you soon. Take care.
And you too.
Tara.